You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. If I akane, coming up on the show, for a weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government choosing not to go ahead with the Climate Change Commission's recommendations on reducing methane emission targets. I also spoke to Boyd Swinburne, a Professor of Population Nutrition and Global Health at the University of Auckland and co-chair of Health Coalition Aotearoa, about San Francisco's lawsuit against companies producing highly processed food and what we could see as a result here in New Zealand. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with Professor in Philosophy at the University of Otago, Lisa Ellis, about the government's decision to reject the Climate Change Commission's recommendation to include shipping and aviation emissions in our national emissions targets and what it means for our Paris Agreement commitments. I also spoke to Chief Advisor at Forest and Bird, Richard Cappy, about the Fast Track Amendment Bill, the lack of engagement with feedback in the Environment Select Committee's report recommending any changes and what it means for our environment.
Here are Ho Whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Te kupatuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Wai Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā rongi te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government has recently rejected all of the Climate Change Commission's recommendations regarding strengthening the country's methane targets. The Commission's recommendations include strengthening the country's 2015 methane emission targets, continuing lowering emissions after 2050, and that international shipping and aviation, which represents 9% of the country's total emissions, should be included within targets. Despite the Commission saying that there would be upfront costs, many of the changes would result in cost savings over time. However, the government has rejected this claim. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government rejecting these recommendations. Why does the government disagree with the Commission's recommendations here?
Well, the government's response was practical, and that's to prioritise measures that plausibly reduce real-world warming, like updating our methane emissions target to a 14 to 24% reduction from 2017 levels by the time we get to 2050. That's quite a significant reduction in methane emissions, which primarily come from New Zealand's primary production activities, from sheep and beef farming, for example. But what the government wanted to avoid was those heavy-handed climate settings that the Climate Commission suggested. They're actually going to worsen the cost of living pressures and, of course, shift New Zealand's emissions offshore without actually doing anything for the client for the climate. Now, you know, ACT has always said you do not fix the climate by virtue signalling here in New Zealand, continuing to demand the same products and services that you would anyway, but outsourcing the climate emissions to countries that do not have the same efficiencies, do not have an emissions trading scheme and do not pay for their carbon in the way Kiwi consumers do. So look, on balance, the government said, look, what the Climate Change Commission was proposing were interesting ideas, but not something that the government would take up.
The government also rejected the Commission's advice to continue lowering emissions after 2050. Does the government not view the climate crisis as a long-term continuous crisis needing to be addressed?
Well, I think that's unhelpful. The government has signed up to a net zero 2050 target, along with many other developing economies. Some countries, like China, have said they're not going to be able to meet that, and they're talking about targets like out in the 2060s, same as India. They're obviously not making any progress towards that at all. Those countries are actually going backwards, given the number of coal-fired power stations, about two a week, that China has brought online since signing up to that commitment. So, you know, the New Zealand government is doing what's practical, what's pragmatic. We've said we're going to aim for this 2050 net zero target, but we're certainly not going to be taking actions that impoverish New Zealanders, you know, risk our exports without any scientific evidence that they would credibly reduce global emissions.
Greenpeace says this government is acting like climate deniers, rejecting science, reviving and subsidising fossil fuels and weakening the methane target. Every move this government makes pushes us deeper into the climate crisis. What do you make of this statement?
Well, Greenpeace are simply human deniers. I mean, it's all very well for them to say all of these things, but you know, governments have to make responsible decisions that balance the needs of all New Zealanders. And we already have an emissions trading scheme currently running between $50 and $60 per tonne of carbon. So everyone listening to this show who's got the lights on and the power on right now is paying for the emissions from Huntly Power Station's coal-fired units, from the gas generators running at Taranaki Combined Cycle now, which provide a significant amount of firm baseload electricity to New Zealand's grid. Without it, wind and solar could not actually keep the lights on. So everyone listening is paying for their emissions from those power stations. If you caught a bus, the diesel fuel, that also is covered by the emissions trading scheme, so you're paying for your emissions there. I mean, Kiwis are doing their bit. The government is doing our part globally. So I totally reject what Greenpeace is saying.
As well as all of this, Finance Minister Nicol Willis, speaking to the Finance and Expenditure Committee and to reporters afterwards, ruled out paying other countries to meet the 2030 climate target under the Paris Agreement. She essentially says the government plans to either meet this target only through emissions targets at home or to not meet the target at all. Despite the reversal of various climate-related targets, are you confident the country will be able to meet the 2030 climate target under the Paris Agreement?
Well, the government is doing everything that it must do, and you know, that includes putting out an emissions reduction plan which shows how the target will be met. But we must also remember that achieving the target won't be known for at least 1 or 2 years after 2030, when essentially the receipts are all added up. In the meantime, New Zealand has to continue doing what is important, which is we've got a cap on emissions through the emissions trading scheme. Kiwis are paying for their emissions. If the price goes up, then they have an incentive to reduce the amount of carbon they use. Now, but by the same token, the government has to prioritise keeping the lights on, affordable and reliable electricity. Sustainability is important, but if you can't afford to pay for electricity, and if you can't get a job because factories, manufacturers and local businesses are closing, including food and hospitality, because they can't afford to pay for energy, then none of this matters. We'll simply be poorer sitting in cold, dark homes, and we won't have done anything to fix the climate.
Do you think that this, alongside reversing the ban on offshore oil and gas exploration and reducing our methane emission target from 24 to 47% to 14 to 25%, for example, will have an impact heading into next year's general elections?
Yeah, I think the impact will be that instead of this upward pressure on household living costs, that these what you might call overly ambitious, or some people might say suicidal climate targets that the previous government adopted were basically driving New Zealand into darkness. What I think people will experience as they get closer to the next election is actually some relief on household budgets, and a sense that actually, like the rest of the world, we will continue to need oil, gas, diesel, plastics and all of these other things that are created from using our petroleum hydrocarbon resources here in New Zealand in order to be a successful developed country. Now, at some point in the future, technologies will arrive, you know, whether it's turning algae into plastic or I don't know, New Zealand might one day wake up and decide they want small nuclear reactors to replace our gas and coal. All of these things are available to us in the future. But right now, we just need to focus on the fact that Kiwis have had a really tough few years with high inflation, high interest rates, and actually just providing for their families, creating a bit of headroom so they can pay down their mortgages. And if you're wanting to get on the property ladder, thinking about, you know, actually, can I save enough for a deposit to buy my first home, you know, an apartment, a unit somewhere? These are all the things this government is focusing on as we get closer to the next election.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the government rejecting the Climate Change Commission's recommendations to strengthen the country's methane targets.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire. Last week, the government announced that they would not be making changes to the way we calculate our emissions targets according to the advice of the Climate Change Commission. One change that was rejected was the inclusion of international shipping and aviation emissions. The flying and shipping that is so key to New Zealand's economy through tourism and elsewhere is excluded from our emissions targets despite being a significant chunk of our emissions. This means, however, that in the face of our Paris Agreement commitments, the government has opted to keep working with an incomplete picture of our economy's emissions. I spoke to Professor of Philosophy at the University of Otago, Lisa Ellis, about these emissions and what this rejection means for how we present ourselves as neighbours and a member of the international community. Just to get us started, what did the Climate Change Commission actually recommend about these emissions and why?
Oh, well, the Climate Commission recommended that we include international aviation and shipping in our 2050 net zero targets. And they had good reasons for doing that. They noted that international aviation emissions amount to about 9% of all our domestic emissions. So because we are such a remote country, so dependent on international aviation, we have a large sort of effect on the world through our international travel and international shipping. And it's important for us to do our fair share by accounting for that. They also noticed that other countries are moving in that direction. The global direction of travel is to include international aviation and shipping in the 2050 net zero targets. The European Union is doing that for their 2030 targets. The UK is set to legislate that in 2026. And so this puts us out of step with our major trading partners. It's also simply part of the process for aligning ourselves with our Paris goals. And the Commission noted that we have new scientific information about what's compatible with maintaining a rise in global mean surface temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius and not higher. That turns out to be more challenging globally than we thought back in 2015. And so we need to be more ambitious. All of us together need to be more ambitious than we were in 2015. And that's how the Paris Agreement works. So the Climate Commission said it would be a good idea for us to be more ambitious than we were originally, to include net negative carbon emissions to make up for things like our high international aviation emissions and our high methane emissions. And that would put us on target to be a country that has emissions that are compatible with a not disastrous world.
And when looking, especially in the context of, as you said, our economy is very reliant on these emissions based on where we are in the world, and thinking about these Paris our Paris Agreement commitments, why is it really important that we get a handle on these emissions specifically?
Well, I think there are several different ways to think about it, and they all point in the same direction. So if we were simply interested in supporting our international agricultural exports, our other exports, and our tourism industry, then we would want to be able to assure our customers and our trading partners that when they spend money in Aotearoa, New Zealand, they're not supporting the destruction of the earth. And the Paris Agreement makes it possible for us to make those sorts of guarantees because if we have net zero targets and we've accounted for our disproportionate aviation emissions by doing other things, maybe we've gone even further than we've already gone in hydropower and we've got a greater reliance on renewables than we had in the past. Or maybe we've committed to net negative emissions, combining reducing our reducible emissions as much as possible and then adding sequestration of carbon using multiple modes, you know, not just forestry, but other modes of carbon sequestration, then our customers and our trading partners could be confident that economic interaction with Aotearoa New Zealand isn't something that destroys everybody's collective future. It makes us a better trading partner. So just from a purely economic, selfish position, I think the Climate Commission's advice was quite good. You know, and they said it was compatible with economic growth and would have less than 0.2% effect on independently on our economic growth. And it, the co-benefits would likely make up for that. But then there are other reasons that we ought to conform to our Paris Accord commitments, and those are that we want to be good neighbors and good ancestors. So if we think everybody else should make efforts to make sure that global emissions stay under the, basically there's a carbon budget cap, and if we emit more than the budget, we will expose ourselves to increasingly frequent and extreme climate harm. So there's a limited budget that we can emit, and if we emit more than our share, we're being unfair to all of our international neighbors, especially to our Pacific neighbors who are disproportionately vulnerable, and we're also being bad ancestors because we're transferring the burden of climate adaptation onto our children and grandchildren.
And so with all of that in mind, why have the government rejected this recommendation?
Well, you'd have to ask them. I really am mystified because the climate minister has repeatedly said that the government is committed to our Paris targets and to our targets under the Zero Carbon Act, the Amendment Act of 2019, which was, of course, a cross-party agreement that included a lot of negotiated compromise so that it was supposed to represent pretty much everybody in the country. And we've heard from this government repeatedly that they're committed to that, but their actions are in exactly the opposite direction. And frankly, it's very hard for people like me to understand how their commitments and their actions could be, you know, so far apart.
So then, looking at this kind of rejection, both in the context of our unique economy and what is becoming a history with the refusal of net negative targets, with the refusal of limiting methane emissions, and just general lack of commitment to a lot of these Paris Agreement commitments, what does this say about the wider ethos of our government when it comes to climate change and our environment?
I really worry that it reflects on all of us collectively. When our international trading partners look at our recent bad behavior, they're not going to blame it on a specific government. They're going to think Aotearoa New Zealand is no longer a member of the coalition of high ambition. Aotearoa New Zealand is no longer a place I can safely invest my money. Aotearoa New Zealand is no longer a place that I can count on to have a sort of a clean, green attitude to economic activity. And I don't think they're going to differentiate amongst our, you know, every 3 years new elected government. So I think all of us going forward are really risking our international cooperative reputation. I mean, there's been just such a long string of recent failures to cooperate with people we normally are on side with. It was really, I don't know, internationally humiliating for us to, for example, refuse to say anything about the postponement of the new regulations in international shipping. Those were absolutely modest and reasonable and compatible with economic growth, and they brought international shipping into the sort of global effort to reduce emissions for the first time. All of the negotiations were finished, and then all of a sudden, because a few countries were basically bullying everybody else, the new regulations were postponed. If you think about it, it really doesn't make sense to exempt international shipping and aviation, because what that means is, given the fact that there's a limited carbon budget, what that means is all the other sectors have to carry them for free. If you think about it, you know, kerosene for international aviation is untaxed completely. If you're in the European Union and you're flying domestically, you pay a tax on it. If you're in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and you're flying domestically, you pay a tax on it. Soon, European Union and UK countries' international aviation will be taxed. And under regulations that have been withdrawn in the United States, that would have been the case too. But right now, what the case is if you fly to, you know, privately to your third beach house, you pay no tax. But if you feed your child, you know, rice cereal, you pay GST on that. Every other activity, housing and food and local transport, are carrying the load of international aviation, and it's really deeply unfair. In Aotearoa, New Zealand, it looks like if we continue on the current path, more than half of our emissions will be devoted to international aviation. And I think if you ask ordinary people, you know, do I want to pay more for metals and more for food and more for local transport so that I can carry international aviation? I think people might wonder whether that's a good deal. Internationally, they would surely wonder if we get up to, I don't know, a quarter of our carbon budget taken by international aviation. That means that one out of four of our units of emissions aren't going to feed people or house people or move them around locally. They're going to fly people over long haul distances. I don't think this policy status quo is something that most people would agree with if they understood it.
So then, just finally, thinking selfishly in terms of us as a trade partner, in terms of New Zealand's economy and growth, and in terms of what we are paying for to make up for these emissions, what do you expect to kind of see then from the government, and what should we see from the government in terms of the right move?
Well, I think in 2019... we were praised internationally for our incredibly forward-thinking and progressive Zero Carbon Act. And the institutions that went along with it were also in step with the latest thinking on how we can have sort of non-tyrannical, not one-size-fits-all, reasonable policies that will also allow us to avoid the worst climate harm. And those policies included incremental reassessing of our targets with the latest scientific data so that we can always be in step with avoiding disaster. And they included allowing people at the local, especially the national level, to make decisions about how to distribute their basket of fair share of carbon emissions. Part of that institutional framework from 2019 was setting up the Climate Commission, Hepoa Rangi, and allowing these experts with a sort of mission to give us advice on how we can both transition to a low emission economy and continue to flourish. And they have been doing that. And we ought to listen to them. Ignoring our own best source of advice is a huge mistake. And I don't think it's rocket science to do the right thing. What we should do is follow the right course that we set up in 2019 in cross-party agreement. I just think as soon as people understand this complicated policy, they immediately recognize how counterproductive our recent behavior has been. It just doesn't make sense to tax your baby's first carrot and not your third flight to your fourth beach house. That doesn't reflect anybody's settled ideas about how we should live together.
That was Professor of Philosophy at the University of Otago, Lisa Ellis, on New Zealand's shipping and aviation emissions and what our refusal to include them in our targets means for us as we work towards our climate commitments.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire. We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Garth! Garth! Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no-hat, no-play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Wallao Radio. 2 hours of music from Southeast Asia and its diaspora, complete with spicy takes, close inspections, interviews, and everything in between.
Hey. She wanna man a slide, that's why she got that.
Wallao Radio, Monday nights, 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. Brought to you by your hosts, Otto and JC, only on 95BFM.
Wallawe!
Ah! Guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday, only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
To
That was Carousel by Hatchie. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire here on 95BFM.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
A 64-page San Francisco lawsuit has been filed against 10 companies producing highly processed food. The lawsuit targets Kraft Heinz Company, Post Holdings, the Coca-Cola Company, PepsiCo, General Mills, Nestle USA, Kellogg, Mars Incorporated, and others, accusing these companies of using harmful practices such as making these products addictive in nature. I spoke to Boyd Swinburne, a professor of population nutrition and global health at the University of Auckland and co-chair of Health Coalition Aotearoa, about San Francisco's lawsuit and what we could see as a result here in New Zealand. To start, who are some of these companies and what sort of food products are we seeing in this lawsuit?
Well, these are some of the 10 biggest corporations like Coca-Cola, Nestle, Heinz and so on, who produce ultra-processed foods. So these are the foods put together in factories full of additives like sugar, fat and salt, and full of added ingredients, colorings, flavorings, emulsifiers and so on. It's all what you find in the center of the supermarket. And those are the corporations that San Francisco is suing.
And stepping back a little bit, what impact does highly processed food have on us when we consume highly processed food?
Well, it's a bit of a mixture of products, as you might imagine, just thinking about the centre of the supermarket. But a recent report that came out a couple of weeks ago from Lancet showed that it is related, the high intake of ultra-processed food is related to the incidence of problems like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, mental health, cancer, and mortality, total mortality. So a wide range of diseases are linked to a high intake of ultra-processed foods.
Are these products adequately portraying, I guess, how processed they are and maybe what sort of impacts they can have on people?
The reason that the San Francisco city is taking these corporations to court is because they are knowingly making products which are harmful. We've known about the harm and the impacts for a long time. They try to hide the truth. They will fight against any public health policies. They make a large profit, and San Francisco wants them to be brought to account and help to pay for some of the consequences that they create.
Have we seen something similar in nature beforehand in the US and maybe overseas?
Well, absolutely. And San Francisco has a strong track record of taking tobacco industry, the lead paint industry and opioid manufacturers to account, taking them to court and winning. And so they will not be taking this case on lightly. They know how to do it. And I think it's going to be the first of multiple cases in the US where they hold these ultra-processed food corporations to account.
You mentioned tobacco and lead paint, lead-based paint there. This lawsuit puts this puts processed food in the same category as these, as well as other harmful substances, as a sort of comparison for the addictive nature of how addicting these products can be. Is this, I guess, an adequate representation on how addictive highly processed food is?
Well, some of it's addictive. Obviously, tobacco is addictive, but lead paint isn't. So it's just the nature of the harm of the product, whether or not they're addictive, and shifting the burden and the blame, I guess, onto those manufacturers who are making high profits out of harmful products. So I think that this is changing the balance, it's changing the narrative by putting ultra-processed foods in the same bucket as those known harm products. I think does change the mindset. It sort of says, hey, we need to pay attention to this. These are the products that are creating the biggest impact on death and disease in New Zealand. We need to do something about it in this country.
And speaking more to New Zealand and I guess how we consume highly processed food, is there any sort of specific differences with processed food in the US compared to highly processed food here in New Zealand?
One of the big problems we have in New Zealand is we don't know what our consumption of ultra-processed food is. It's incredible. Well, we haven't had a nutrition survey since 2007 in adults and since 2002 in children. So our biggest cause of death and disease we don't actually measure, which is a disgrace. But however, compared to probably Australians and Canadians and so on, my estimate is that our ultra-processed food consumption is probably over 50% of our diet, probably a bit higher in young people. and that is a major concern. So I think we need to start measuring what these problems are and start acting on them with policies.
And have we seen a more or recent pushes to update those statistics that you just mentioned? I mean, you mentioned it was in, back in 2007 for adults in 2002, right? Have we seen more recent pushes to see how it's impacting New Zealanders?
Well, the Ministry of Health has done all the basic work for a proper nutrition survey, but it just has not been approved as a budget item, and so it just gets delayed and delayed. But we have had small studies around in New Zealand, and also, as I said, comparing it with Australia. My guess is that it's around 50%. Even for under fives, if we go by Australians, they're probably consuming about 45% of their diet as ultra-processed foods. So this has taken over, if you like, our real food system, as it has in most countries. And it's this kind of colonisation and taking over of our real food system that has meant it's so dominant in our diet, and therefore we get all these diseases and problems downstream from a high consumption.
Why is it so dominant in terms of what food we decide to eat, I guess?
Well, it is highly prominent, and it's not so much what we decide to eat. Yes, there is consumer choice involved in all of this, but if you look around the world, it's this sort of domination of the ultra-processed food system. You know, that what are the foods that are highly manufactured to give us hyper-palatability, you know, where they taste so palatable and so addictive, if you like. Just think of Coca-Cola and Pringles as examples. They are heavily marketed, including to children. They are present everywhere. They're what's on special. They're at the front of the aisle in the supermarkets. So they're absolutely kind of imposed upon us. And we like them. We like their taste. We like the long shelf life and so on. And so we've just ended up in this situation where our consumption is really high. But also these companies have predated upon those people who are more vulnerable, people who are really struggling with income, children and so on. And those are the ones more vulnerable, and those are the ones they target the most. You just need to go to a low-income suburb, a more disadvantaged suburb, and you'll see it's absolutely chock-a-block full of fast food outlets. And you go to a wealthy suburb, and there are very few there. So they definitely target those people who are most at risk and most vulnerable.
Could the San Francisco lawsuit have a large impact on companies here?
Yeah, I think so. It's not going to happen overnight, because these companies will fight it tooth and nail. But it will, and as I said before, I think it changes the mindset. How do we think about this food? It's not just regular food. In fact, people call it sort of edible food-like substances. You know, it's changing our perception about the level of danger and harm from a high consumption of these products. Not to say that a small consumption is a problem, but if this is a large proportion of your diet, then you're at risk of all of those health complications.
What about consumers? Do you think this lawsuit will garner a lot of public discourse here in New Zealand?
Well, I hope so. I hope that it lifts the game. I mean, in New Zealand, we've had very little action whatsoever on food policies, on improving the food environment to make healthy choices, healthy foods easier and cheaper and so on. And so Health Coalition Aotearoa, which I co-chair, is calling for multiple policies like we've seen in Latin American countries to be implemented. So these are front-of-pack warning labels. They're bans on advertising and marketing to kids. They are taxes on sugary drinks and unhealthy foods. And they are getting junk food out of schools, getting ultra-processed foods out of schools. So those are the four planks. If you implement all of those, as they are in many countries in Latin America and some countries in Europe, then I think we've got a much better chance of pegging back the problems, especially the obesity and diabetes problems.
You kind of touched a little bit on my last question here, but if San Francisco were to win this case, what are you hoping comes out of this lawsuit? What is the end goal here?
The end goal is the reduction in consumption of ultra-processed foods and better health. That's what we're aiming for. When we look at the proportion of contribution of these foods to our ill health, it's probably contributing about 15% of our avoidable disabilities and diseases and premature deaths. That's compared to smoking, which is about 9%. So it is a big contributor. And so the end goal is to improve health, to give people more choices of healthy foods, and to we do that by reducing consumption. But we won't reduce consumption just by telling people. We need to influence the food environment to make it much easier to get healthy food and more difficult or not as heavily promoted the unhealthy food.
That was the University of Auckland and Health Coalition Aotearoa's Boyd Swinburne on San Francisco's lawsuit against companies producing highly processed food and what, if anything, we could see as a result here in New Zealand.
When you see Paris Hilton carrying a chihuahua in a handbag, then suddenly there's going to be a certain segment of the New Zealand population that are suddenly going to want a chihuahua.
Hoo-wire.
We'll be right back.
You kicked the door through. I kept my promise to help you. Pictures on the white walls don't help. Wishing I could take them down myself. Need you to keep your eyes on me. Your state of mind is always on a come down. Keep your eyes on me. Your state of mind, it's always on a come down.
doggone, my personality is based on food. Now take it from Bogdan, he's my veterinarian. His folks are from Croatia, they've been through some shit. Man, I seem like such a bitch when I talk about Swedish politics. Or maybe he's Australian, I never really listen when he's talking about himself. Of exotic breeds especially. Is Bogdan my enemy? Does he want the best for me? What's he doing with my teeth? Is he taking them to Australia? His folks have seen some shit. I seem like such a bitch. His folks have seen some shit. I seem like such a bitch. 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 I found a crouton underneath the futon. Mama said I couldn't eat it, cause all my teeth are gone. My personality is based on food now. Take it from Bogdan, he's my veterinarian. His folks are from Croatia, they've been through some shit. Man, I seem like such a bitch when I talk about Swedish politics.
That was Uno 2 by the Viagra Boys, and before that was Pinwheel by Dropper featuring Evelyn Breaker. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. Last week, the Fast Track Amendment Bill left the Select Committee process after just 10 days. The report on the amendment by the Environment Selected Committee recommended no changes to the amendment on account of time constraints and other planned amendments. However, this goes against the fact that this amendment and the earlier Fast Track Bill have proven to be exceptionally unpopular. The original bill saw a massive amount of protest and submissions to the Select Committee expressing concern over the bill and its effects on the environment and iwi. This time, the amendment was only given these 10 days and still saw over 2,500 individuals and groups making submissions, but the committee has still seen fit to ignore these concerns. I spoke to Chief Advisor at Forest and Bird, Richard Cappy, about this Select Committee report and what it says about the government avoiding accountability and public opinion to push through changes like this bill. Why is Forest and Bird so concerned about this bill?
So the original fast-track legislation that was passed right at the start of the year is a really bad piece of legislation. It strips out environmental protections and is really worrying. And that's why, you know, you had 25,000 people march down Queen Street saying, actually, this isn't what we want for New Zealand. What this particular bill is something that's been rushed through late this year under the pretense of it being about kind of improving grocery competition, so fixing the supermarket sector. But actually what it is making that original fast-track legislation even worse. So what it is doing is taking away what few remaining environmental protections have been in place and cutting out the ability of communities' ability to have their voices heard. So we've got a situation just now where we've got panels being set up around the country to hear about these fast-track applications. So these are the really big applications for things like massive housing developments, new roads. Some of the most contentious ones are around things like coal mines or seabed mining. And these panel, the job of the panels is to look at all the information that's provided, go out and ask for information from experts and things like that if they need it, and then make a decision. This particular piece of legislation is limiting the panel's ability to go and talk to organizations like Forest and Bird or local community groups or groups who've got expert information that could actually help them with their decision-making. It just doesn't make any sense.
So looking then at the Select Committee report from the Environment Select Committee, what is this report kind of saying about this process and how the government is engaging with the process?
Yeah, and this is the thing that I think everybody, you know, 95% of people who submitted on this bill basically said, look, we don't agree with this legislation. We don't understand what the problem is that you're trying to solve. Because actually, this is a really unusual kind of piece of legislation. There's normally a thing called a regulatory impact assessment, which says, hey, we've looked at all of this, and this is the reason why this legislation needs to take place, and this is what all the consequences would be. And that hasn't taken place. And there isn't really what you'd call the kind of statement about what the problem is they're trying to solve. And that's what everybody's kind of really frustrated about. You know, the difficulty with this is that the Select Committee report shows that, frankly, the government just doesn't want to listen. It doesn't want to listen to the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, the panel conveners, the Law Society, groups like Forest and Bird, iwi. There are so many people who have come out and said, look, we don't quite understand what you're trying to do here, but what you are proposing to do, we have deep concerns about. It basically suggests that the government is hell-bent on opening the door to development, pretty much at any cost to the environment and future generations. It's also been pushed through at a ridiculous pace. So, you know, for those of us who care about these things, there's, you know, making good laws means that if you make a, you know, if you develop laws in the right way, then it means that they're going to be better in the long term. You'll end up with less challenges to them, and it just means the whole process will be run smoothly. People were given 10 days to submit on this. You know, that's just ridiculous. And then you had, you know, 2,500 individuals and groups who, even though there was bugger all time, still managed to provide some feedback. It's just not good enough. You know, this is intergenerational changes that will change New Zealand's landscape and communities forever. And we had 10 working days to provide any kind of comments on that. It's not very good. You know, it's not how we should be doing things.
So as you said, there was, you know, a lack of regulatory impact assessments. There was a lack of this kind of window was very small. Is this lack of listening or this lack of engagement, is it a product of ignorance or does it kind of seem like a intentional disregard from the government?
I would say that this is being presented as a fait accompli. So it's like, we want to make these changes and actually we're not particularly concerned about what other people think. We might make some tweaks around the edges, but actually we want to make sure that ministers have got the powers to green light projects. We want to reduce the power of the panels to call people. We want to reduce the ability of people to challenge really bad decisions in the courts. And we want to make it much, much easier for developments to drive through regardless of the environmental impacts. That seems to be where the government is coming from, rather than thinking about, hey, what's a good piece of lawmaking which will let us get really critical projects through a consenting system faster, but with really good decision-making, having thought through all the stuff that we need to do to make sure that these projects are really successful going forward if they are the right projects to happen. So, yeah, you know, it's being driven through at a ridiculous pace in a way that, yeah, is really cutting not just the New Zealand public out of the process, but the way that the legislation's been done technically means that Parliament's actually got less time to even look at it. So that there are changes that are going to be made to this law that are going to, you know, basically bypass the normal kind of debating and voting that you'd have in Parliament. You know, this is, it's not just really bad lawmaking and really bad for the environment, but it's quite anti-democratic in a lot of ways.
And so looking at just this amendment and this Select Committee process and report, what do you actually want to see from the government in terms of, okay, if this legislation is going to go forth and we are going to amend it, what sort of engagement and interaction do you want to see from the Select Committee in terms of actually holding these changes accountable?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? The Select Committee itself has only provided suggested changes. Normally it would provide recommendations. And then those suggested changes will be picked up later on by what's called the Committee of the Whole House stage. So that means it bypasses a second reading. But, you know, that's all technical stuff. The bit that I think we've all looked at this and kind of gone, fixing grocery competition on those clauses, you know, grocery competition is only mentioned once in the entire bill. But if you want to make changes around grocery competition, go for it. I don't think anybody has any issues with that. But the proposed amendments in the bill just need to get thrown out. Limiting the amount of time that a panel will have to do these things, introducing a national policy statement, which means ministers will basically be able to greenlight pet projects. There's a whole raft of things. The whole intent behind this bill is fundamentally flawed. You know, will panels have the ability to collect the information they want and need? No. Will communities be able to actually have their voices heard? No. Will ministers be able to directly influence applications? Absolutely. Are New Zealanders going to end up with worse projects? Absolutely. You know, it was a bad law to start with at the start of this year. It's turning into something that, frankly, is just disgraceful.
When we're looking at this amendment and this process and that earlier bill, how does it kind of fit into this wider ethos from the government that is showing this disregard for public feedback, that is showing disregard for regulation, and is, quite frankly, showing disregard for the environment?
I think there's some really concerning stuff happening where, you know, it's been called a war on nature. And I think if you think about the announcements that were made about methane targets and our international climate change commitments the other day, rolling those back. If you think about the changes that have been driven through reducing protection for our fresh water, if you think about the fact that we're still allowing things like bottom trawling to take place, and then if you think about the fact that tomorrow we will have resource management changes rolled through, which are much, much more likely to roll back environmental protections. Collectively, you know, the government is taking a very, very short-termist economic development at any cost approach to things. And one thing that we do know is New Zealanders care deeply about their environment. You know, they understand that it's incredibly important to our economy, but it's also incredibly important in terms of who we are. You know, we identify ourselves by our connections to rivers, mountains, land, you know, and unfortunately, the direction that we've seen under the coalition government is so many of the things that enable us to look after and nurture and protect these special places are being pushed to one side. And that means we've got unswimmable lakes and rivers. It means we're setting ourselves up for a bit of a nightmare scenario in terms of our obligations and commitments to do something about climate change, as well as, you know, so many other aspects of environmental protections is getting rolled back. And that's just so incredibly frustrating and disappointing. You know, there are opportunities to embrace our environment and set ourselves on a different path, but we seem to be hell-bent on economic development at any cost just now, and actually, that's not good enough.
That was Forest and Bird Chief Advisor Richard Cappy on the Fast Track Amendment Bill, the limited scrutiny that's been applied to it, and what this means about the government's priorities.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, the University of Otago's Lisa Ellis, the University of Auckland and Health Coalition Aotearoa's Boyd Swinburne, and Forest and Bird's Richard Cape. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.